and what he calls my head for history to set up a familiar thesis that I live in the past. Canon Mackey makes me wonder if my devotion to the memory of Canon Campbell is not also an aspect of how much I live in the past. Years ago, when I felt so close to Canon Campbell, I lived less in the past. Or else, what we now call the past was then the present. It was the actual time that Canon Campbell and I shared, and we were both caught up in it. If Canon Campbell were alive, if he were still rector of Grace Church, perhaps he would be no more sympathetic to me than Canon Mackey is sympathetic today. Canon Campbell was alive on January 21, 1977. That was the day President Jimmy Carter issued a pardon to the draft dodgers. What did I care? I was already a Canadian citizen. Although Canon Campbell cautioned me about my anger, too, he understood why that pardon made me so angry. I showed Canon Campbell the letter I wrote to Jimmy Carter. "Dear Mr. President," I wrote, "who will pardon the United States?" Who can pardon the United States? How can they be pardoned for Vietnam, for their conduct in Nicaragua, for their steadfast and gross contribution to the proliferation of nuclear arms? "John, John," Canon Mackey said, "your little speech about Christmas at the parish council meeting, I doubt that even Scrooge would have chosen a parish council meeting as the proper occasion for such an announcement. I merely said that I found Christmas depressing," I said. "Merely," said Canon Mackey. "The church counts very heavily on Christmas, for its missions, for its livelihood in this city, and Christmas is the focal point for the children in our church." And what would the canon have said if I'd told him that the Christmas of 53 put the finishing touches on Christmas for me? He would have told me, again, that I was living in the past. So I said nothing. I hadn't wanted to talk about Christmas in the first place. Is it any wonder how Christmas, ever since that Christmas, depresses me? The nativity I witnessed in 53 has replaced the old story. The Christ is born, miraculously, to be sure, but even more miraculous are the demands he succeeds in making, even before he can walk. Not only does he demand to be worshipped and adored by peasants and royalty, by animals and his own parents, but he also banishes his mother and father from the house of prayer and song itself. I will never forget the inflamed color of his bare skin in the winter cold, and the hospital white on white of his swaddling clothes against the new snow. A vision of the little Lord Jesus as a born victim, born raw, born bandaged, born angry and accusing, and wrapped so tightly that he could not bend at the knees at all and had to lie in his parents' laps as stiffly as someone who, mortally wounded, lies upon a stretcher. How can you like Christmas after that? Before I became a believer, I could at least enjoy the fantasy. That Sunday, feeling the wind cut through my Joseph robe out on Elliott Street contributed to my belief in and my dislike of the miracle. How the congregation straggled out of the nave. How they hated to have their rituals revised without warning. The rector was not on the steps to shake their hands because so many of the congregation had followed our triumphant exit, leaving the Reverend Mr. Wiggin stranded at the altar with his benediction unsaid. He was supposed to have delivered his benediction from the nave, where the recessional should have led him, and not us. And what was Barb Wiggin supposed to do with the pillar of light, now that she had craned the light to follow the Lord Jesus and his tribe to the door? Dan Needham told me later that the Reverend Dudley Wiggin made a most unusual gesture for the rector of Christ Church to make from the pulpit. He drew his forefinger across his throat, a signal to his wife to kill the light, which, only after we'd departed, she finally did. But to many of the bewildered congregation, who took their cues from the rector, for how else should they know what their next move should be in this unique celebration, The gesture of the Reverend Dudley Wiggins slashing his own throat was particularly gripping. Mr. Fish, in his inexperience, imitated the gesture as if it were a command, and then looked to Dan for approval. Dan observed that Mr. Fish was not alone. And what were we supposed to do? Our gang from the manger, ill-dressed for the weather, huddled uncertainly together after the granite truck turned onto Front Street and out of sight. The revived hind part of one donkey ran to the door of the parish house vestibule, which he found locked. The cows slipped in the snow. Where could we go but back in the main door? Had someone locked the parish house out of fear that thieves would steal our real clothes? To our knowledge, there was no shortage of clothes like ours in Gravesend, and no robbers. And so we bucked against the grain. We fought against the congregation, they were coming out, in order that we might get back in. For Barb Wiggin, who wished that every worship service was as smooth as a flight free of bumpy air, and one that departs and arrives on time, the sight of the traffic jam in the nave of the church must have caused further upset. Smaller angels and shepherds darted between the grown-ups' legs, the more stately kings clutching their toppled crowns, and the clumsier cows and the donkeys, now in halves, made awkward progress against the flow of bulky overcoats. The countenances of many a parishioner reflected shock and insult, as if the Lord Jesus had just spat in their faces to deem them sacrilegious. Among the older members of the congregation, with whom the jocular Captain Wiggin and his brash wife were not an overnight success, there was a stewing anger apparent in their frowns and scowls, as if the shameful pageant they had just witnessed were the rector's idea of something modern. Whatever it was, they hadn't liked it, and their reluctant acceptance of the ex-pilot would be delayed for a few more years. I found myself chin to chest with the Reverend Lewis Merrill, who was as baffled as the Episcopalian congregation regarding what he and his wife were supposed to do next. They were nearer the nave of the church than was the rector, who was nowhere to be found, and if the Reverend Mr. Merrill continued to press with the throng toward the door, he might find himself out on the steps, in a position to shake hands with the departing souls in advance of the Reverend Mr. Wiggins' appearance there. It was surely not Pastor Merrill's responsibility to shake hands with Episcopalians following their botched pageant. God forbid that any of them might think that he was the reason for the pageant being so peculiarly wrecked, or that this was how the Congregationalists interpreted the Nativity. "Your little friend," Mr. Merrill asked in a whisper, "is he always so... like that?" "Is he always like what?" I thought. But in the crush of the crowd, it would have been hard to stand my ground while Mr. Merrill stuttered out what he meant. "Yes," I said. "That's Owen. This was pure Owen today. He's unpredictable, but he's always in charge." "He's quite miraculous," the Reverend Mr. Merrill said, smiling faintly, clearly glad that the Congregationalists preferred caroling to pageants, and clearly relieved that Owen Meany had moved no farther down the Protestant rungs than the Episcopalians. The pastor was probably imagining what sort of damage Owen might accomplish at a Vesper service. Dan grabbed me in the connecting passage to the parish house. He said he'd wait for me to get my clothes and Owen's. We could go back to the dorm together then, or to 80 Front Street. Mr. Fish was happy and agitated. If he thought that the Reverend Dudley Wiggins slashing his throat was a part of the rector's annual performance, he also imagined that everything Owen had done was in the script, and Mr. Fish had been quite impressed by the dramatic qualities of the story. "I love the part when he tells the angel what to say. That's brilliant," Mr. Fish said. "And how he throws his mother aside, how he starts right in with the criticism. I mean, you get the idea right away that this is no ordinary baby. You know, he's the Lord, Jesus, from day one. I mean, he's born giving orders, telling everyone what to do. I thought you told me he didn't have a speaking part. I had no idea it was so primitive, a ritual so violent, so barbaric. But it's very moving," Mr. Fish added hastily, lest Dan and I be offended to hear our religion described as primitive and barbaric. "It's not quite what the author intended," Dan told Mr. Fish. I left Dan explaining the deviations from the expected to the excited amateur actor. I wanted to get dressed and find Owen's clothes in a hurry, without encountering either of the Wiggins. But I was a while getting my hands on Owen's clothes. Mary Beth Baird had balled them up with her own in a corner of the vestibule, where she then lay down to weep on top of them. It was complicated getting her to relinquish Owen's clothes without striking her, and impossible to interrupt her sobbing. Everything that had upset the little Lord Jesus had been her fault, in her opinion. She had not only failed to soothe him, she'd been a bad mother in general. Owen hated her, she claimed. How she wished she understood him better. Yet somehow, as she explained to me through her tears, she was sure she understood him better than anyone else did. At age 11, I was too young to glimpse a vision of what sort of overwrought wife and mother Mary Beth Baird would make. There in the vestibule, I wanted only to hit her, to forcibly take Owen's clothes and leave her in a puddle of tears. The very idea of her understanding Owen Meany made me sick. What she really meant was that she wanted to take him home and lie on top of him. Her idea of understanding him began and ended with her desire to cover his body, to never let him get up. Because I was slow in leaving the vestibule, Barb Wiggin caught me. "You can give him this message when you give him his clothes," she hissed to me, her fingers digging into my shoulder and shaking me. "Tell him he's to come see me before he's allowed back in this church, before the next Sunday school class, before he comes to another service. He comes to see me first. He's not allowed here until he sees me," she repeated, giving me one last shake for good measure. I was so upset that I blurted it all out to Dan, who was hanging around the altar area with Mr. Fish, who, in turn, was staring at the scattered hay in the manger and at the few gifts abandoned by the Christ child there, as if some meaning could be discerned from the arrangement of the debris. I told Dan what Barb Wiggin had said, and how she'd given Owen a hard-on, and how there had been virtual warfare between them. And now, I was sure, Owen would never be allowed to be an Episcopalian again. If seeing her was a prerequisite for Owen to return to Christ Church, then Owen, I knew, would be as shunning of us Episcopalians as he was presently shunning of Catholics. I became quite exercised in relating this scenario to Dan, who sat beside me in a front-row pew and listened sympathetically. Mr. Fish came and told us that the angel was still on high. He wondered if this was a part of the script, to leave Harold Crosby hanging in the rafters long after the manger and the pews had emptied. Harold Crosby, who thought both his God and Barb Wiggin had abandoned him forever, swung like the victim of a vigilante killing among the mock-flying buttresses. Dan, an accomplished mechanic of all theatrical equipment, eventually mastered the angel-lowering apparatus and returned the banished angel to terra firma, where Harold collapsed in relief and gratitude. He had thrown up all over himself, and, in attempting to wipe himself with one of his wings, he'd made quite an unsalvageable mess of his costume. That was when Dan carried out his responsibilities as a stepfather in most concrete, even heroic terms. He carried the sodden Harold Crosby to the parish house vestibule, where he asked Barb Wiggin if he might have a word with her. "Can't you see," she asked him, "that this isn't the best of times?" "I should not want to bring up the matter of how you left this boy hanging with the vestry members," Dan said to her. He held Harold Crosby with some difficulty, not only because Harold was heavy and wet, but because the stench of vomit, especially in the close air of the vestibule, was overpowering. "This isn't the best of times to bring up anything with me," Barb Wiggin cautioned. But Dan Needham was not a man to be bullied by a stewardess. "Nobody cares what sort of mess-up happens at a children's pageant," Dan said. "But this boy was left hanging 20 feet above a concrete floor. A serious accident might have occurred due to your negligence." Harold Crosby shut his eyes, as if he feared Barb Wiggin was going to hit him or strap him back in the angel-raising apparatus. "I regret," Barb Wiggin began, but Dan cut her off. "You will not lay down any laws for Owen Meany," Dan Needham told her. "You are not the rector. You are the rector's wife. You had a job, to return this boy safely to the floor, and you forgot all about it. I will forget all about it, too, and you will forget about seeing Owen. Owen is allowed in this church at any time. He doesn't require your permission to be here. If the rector would like to speak with Owen, have the rector call me." And here Dan Needham released the slippery Harold Crosby, whose manner of groping for his clothes suggested that the angel apparatus had cut off all circulation to his legs. He wobbled unsteadily about the vestibule, the other children getting out of his way because of his smell. Dan Needham put his hand on the back of my neck. He pushed me gently forward until I was standing directly between Barb Wiggin and him. "This boy is not your messenger, Mrs. Wiggin," Dan said. "I should not want to bring up any of this with the vestry members," he repeated. Stewardesses have, at best, marginal authority. Barb Wiggin knew when her authority had slipped. She looked awfully ready to please, so ready to please that I was embarrassed for her. She turned her attention eagerly to the task of getting Harold Crosby into fresher clothes. She was just in time. Harold's mother entered the vestibule as Dan and I were leaving the parish house. "My, that looked like fun," Mrs. Crosby said. "Did you have fun, dear?" she asked him. When Harold nodded, Barb Wiggin spontaneously hugged him against her hip. Mr. Fish had found the rector. The Reverend Dudley Wiggin was occupying himself with the Christmas candles, measuring them to ascertain which were still long enough to be used again next year. The Reverend Dudley Wiggin had a pilot's healthy instinct for looking ahead. He did not dwell on the present, especially not on the disasters. He would never call Dan and ask to speak to Owen. Owen would be allowed at Christ Church without any consultation with the rector. "I like the way Joseph and Mary carry the baby Jesus out of the manger," Mr. Fish was saying. "Ah, do you? Ah, yes," the rector said. "It's a great ending, very dramatic," Mr. Fish pointed out. "Yes, it is, isn't it?" the rector said. "Perhaps we'll work out a similar ending next year." "Of course, the part requires someone with Owen's presence," Mr. Fish said. "I'll bet you don't get a Christ child like him every year." "No, not like him," the rector agreed. "He's a natural," Mr. Fish said. "Yes, isn't he?" Mr. Wiggin said. "Have you seen A Christmas Carol?" Mr. Fish asked. "Not this year," the rector said. "What are you doing on Christmas Eve?" Mr. Fish asked him. I knew what I wished I was doing on Christmas Eve. I wished I was in Soya Depot, waiting with my mother for Dan to arrive on the midnight train. That's how our Christmas Eves had been since my mother had gotten together with Dan. Mother and I would enjoy the Eastman's hospitality, and I would exhaust myself with my violent cousins, and Dan would join us after the Christmas Eve performance of the Gravesend Players. He would be tired when he got off the train from Gravesend at midnight, but everyone in the Eastman house, even my grandmother, would be waiting up for him. Uncle Alfred would fix Dan a nightcap, while my mother and Aunt Martha put Noah and Simon and Hester and me to bed. At 11:45, Hester and Simon and Noah and I would bundle up and cross the street to the depot. The weather in the North Country on a Christmas Eve at midnight was not inviting to grown-ups. The grown-ups all approved of letting us kids meet Dan's train. We liked to be early, so we could make plenty of snowballs. The train was always on time in those days. There were few people on it, and almost no one but Dan got off in Sawyer Depot, where we would pelt him with snowballs. As tired as he was, Dan put up a game fight. Earlier in the evening, my mother and Aunt Martha sang Christmas carols. Sometimes my grandmother would join in. We children could remember most of the words to the first verses. It was in the later verses of the carols that my mother and Aunt Martha put their years in the Congregational Church choir to the test. My mother won that contest. She knew every word to every verse, so that, as a carol progressed, we heard nothing at all from Grandmother, and less from Aunt Martha. In the end, my mother got to sing the last verses by herself. "What a waste, Tabby," Aunt Martha would say. "It's an absolute waste of your memory, knowing all those words to the verses no one ever sings." "What else do I need my memory for?" my mother asked her sister. The two women would smile at each other, my Aunt Martha coveting that part of my mother's memory that might tell her the story of who my father was. What really irked Martha about my mother's total recall of Christmas carols was that my mother got to sing those last verses solo. Even Uncle Alfred would stop what he was doing just to listen to my mother's voice. I remember it was at my mother's funeral when the Reverend Lewis Merrill told my grandmother that he'd lost my mother's voice twice. The first time was when Martha got married, because that was when both girls started spending Christmas vacations in Sawyer Depot. My mother would still practice singing carols with the choir, but she was gone to visit her sister by the Sunday of Christmas Vespers. The second time that Pastor Merrill lost my mother's voice was when she moved to Christ Church, when he lost it forever. But I had not lost her voice until Christmas Eve, 1953, when the town I was born in and grew up in felt so unfamiliar to me. Gravesend just never was my Christmas Eve town. Of course, I was grateful to have something to do, although I'd seen every production of A Christmas Carol, including the dress rehearsal, I was especially glad that the final production was available to take up the time on Christmas Eve. I think both Dan and I wanted our time taken up. After the play, Dan had scheduled a cast party, and I understood why he'd done that, to take up every minute until midnight, and even past midnight, so that he wouldn't be thinking of riding the train to Sawyer Depot and my mother in the Eastmans' warm house waiting for him. I could picture the Eastmans having a hard time on Christmas Eve, too. After the first verse, Aunt Martha would be struggling with each carol. Dan had wanted to have the cast party at 80 Front Street, and I understood that, too. He wanted my grandmother to be just as busy as he was. Of course, Grandmother would have complained bitterly about the party revelers and about such a sundry guest list. Given the diverse personalities and social stations of a typical Dan Needham cast, but Grandmother would at least have been occupied. As it was, she refused. Dan had to beg her to get her to see the play. At first, she gave him every excuse. She couldn't possibly leave Lydia alone. Lydia was sick. There was some congestion in her lungs or bronchial tubes, and it was out of the question that Lydia could go out to a play. Furthermore, Grandmother argued, it being Christmas Eve, she had allowed Ethel to visit her next of kin. Ethel would be gone for Christmas Day and the next day, too, and surely Dan knew how Lydia hated to be left alone with Germaine. Dan pointed out that he thought Germaine had been hired specifically to look after Lydia. Yes, Grandmother nodded, that was certainly true. Nevertheless, the girl was dismal, superstitious company, and what Lydia needed on Christmas Eve was company. It was, Dan politely reasoned, strictly for company's sake that he wanted my grandmother to see A Christmas Carol and even spend a short time enjoying the festive atmosphere of the cast party. Since my grandmother had refused him the use of 80 Front Street, Dan had decorated the entire third floor of Waterhouse Hall, opening a few of the less cluttered boys' rooms and the common room on that floor for the cast. His own tiny apartment just wouldn't suffice. He'd alerted the Brinker-Smiths that there might be a rumpus two floors above them. They were welcome to join the festivities or plug up the twins' ears with cotton, as they saw fit. Grandmother did not see fit to do a damn thing, but she enjoyed Dan's efforts to cajole her out of her veteran, antisocial cantankerousness, and she agreed to attend the play. As for the cast party, she would see how she felt after the performance. And so it fell to me, the task of escorting Grandmother to the closing night enactment of A Christmas Carol in the Gravesend Town Hall. I took many precautions along the way to protect Grandmother from fracturing her hip. Although the sidewalks were safely sanded, there'd been no new snowfall, and the well-oiled wood of the old town meeting place was slipperier than any surface Grandmother was likely to encounter outdoors. The hinges of the ancient folding chairs creaked in unison as I led Harriet Wheelwright to a favored center aisle seat in the third row, our townspeople's heads turning in the manner that a congregation turns to view a bride. For my grandmother entered the theater as if she were still responding to a curtain call following her long-ago performance in Mom's The Constant Wife. Harriet Wheelwright had a gift for making a regal entry. There was even some scattered applause, which Grandmother quieted with a well-aimed glower. Respect in the form of awe, preferably silent awe, was something she courted, but hand-clapping was, under the circumstances, vulgar. It took a full 5 minutes for her to be comfortably seated, her mink off, but positioned over her shoulders, her scarf loosened, but covering the back of her neck from drafts, which were known to approach from the rear, her hat on, despite the fact that no one seated behind her could see over it. Graciously, the gentleman so seated moved. At last, I was free to venture backstage, where I had grown used to the aura of spiritual calm surrounding Owen Meany at the makeup mirror. The trauma of the Christmas pageant shone in his eyes, like a death in the family. His cold had settled deep in his chest, and a fever drove him to alternate states. First he burned, then he sweated, then he shivered. He needed very little eyeliner to deepen the darkness entombing his eyes, and his nightly excessive applications of baby powder to his face, which was already as white as the face of a china doll, had covered the makeup table with a silt as fine as plaster dust, in which Owen wrote his name with his finger, in square blocked letters, the style of lettering favored in the Meany Monument Shop. Owen had offered no explanation regarding the offense he took at his parents' attendance at the Christchurch Nativity. When I suggested that his response to their presence in the congregation had been radical and severe, he dismissed me in a fashion he'd perfected, by forgiving me for what I couldn't be expected to know, and what he would never explain to me, that old unspeakable outrage that the Catholics had perpetrated, and his parents' inability to rise above what amounted to the religious persecution they had suffered. Yet it was my opinion that Owen was persecuting his parents. Why they accepted such persecution was a mystery to me. From backstage, I was uniquely positioned to search the audience for the acquiescent presence of Mr. and Mrs. Meany. They were not there. My search was rewarded, however, by the discovery of a sanguinary Mr. Morrison, the cowardly mailman, his eyes darting daggers in all directions and wringing his hands, as he might around a throat, in his lap. The look of a man who's come to see what might have been is full of both bloodshed and nostalgia. Should Owen succumb to his fever, Mr. Morrison looked ready to play the part. It was a full house, To my surprise, I'd seen many of the audience at earlier performances. The Reverend Lewis Merrill, for example, was back for a second, maybe even a third time. He always came to dress rehearsals, and often to a later performance. He told Dan he enjoyed watching the actors settle into their parts. Being a minister, he must have especially enjoyed A Christmas Carol. It was such a heartfelt rendering of a conversion. Not just a lesson in Christian charity, but an example of man's humbleness before the spiritual world. Even so, I could not find Rector Wigan in the audience. I had no expectations of finding Barb, either. I would guess their exposure to Owen Meany's interpretations of the spiritual world was sufficient to inspire them until next Christmas. Lewis Merrill, forever in the company of the sour stamina that radiated from his wife, was also in the company of his troubled children, often rebellious, almost always unruly, uniformly sullen. The Merrill children acted out their displeasure at being dragged to an amateur theatrical. The tallest boy, the notorious cemetery vandal, sprawled his legs into the center aisle, indifferently creating a hazard for the elderly, the infirm, and the unwary. The middle child, a girl, her hair so brutally short, in keeping with her square, shapeless body that she might have been a boy, brooded loudly over her bubblegum. She had sunk herself so low in her seat that her knees caused considerable discomfort to the back of the neck of the unfortunate citizen who sat in front of her. He was a plump, mild, middle-aged man who taught something in the sciences at Gravesend Academy, and when he turned round in his seat to reprove the girl with a scientific glance, she popped a bubble at him with her gum. The third and youngest child, of undetermined sex, crawled under the seats, disturbing the ankles of several surprised theatergoers and coating itself with a film of grime and ashes and all manner of muck that the patrons had brought in upon their winter boots. Through all the unpleasantness created by her children, Mrs. Merrill suffered silently. Although they caused her obvious pain, she was unprotesting. Since nearly everything caused her pain, she thought it would be unfair to single them out for special distinction. Mr. Merrill gazed undistracted toward center stage, apparently transfixed by the crack where the curtain would part. He appeared to believe that by his special scrutiny of this opening, by a supreme act of concentration, he might inspire the curtains to open. Why, then, was he so surprised when they did? Why was I so surprised by the applause that greeted old Scrooge in his counting house? It was the way the play had opened every night. But it wasn't until Christmas Eve that it occurred to me how many of these same townspeople must have been present in those bleacher seats that summer day, applauding, or on the verge of applauding, the force with which Owen Meany struck that ball. And yes, there was fat Mr. Chickering, whose warm-up jacket had kept me from too close a view of the mortal injury. Yes, there was Police Chief Pike. As always, he was stationed by the door, his suspicious eyes roaming the audience as much as they toured the stage, as if Chief Pike suspected that the culprit might have brought the stolen baseball to the play. "If I could work my will," said Mr. Fish indignantly, "every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart." I saw Mr. Morrison silently move his mouth to every word. In the absence of any lines to learn, as the ghost of Christmas yet to come, he had learned all of Scrooge's lines by heart. What had he made of the foul ball that so spectacularly spun my mother around? Had he been there to see Mr. Chickering pinch her splayed knees together for modesty's sake? Just before Owen made contact, my mother had noticed someone in the bleachers. As I remembered it, she was waving to someone just before she was struck. She had not been waving to Mr. Morrison, I was sure. His cynical presence didn't inspire a greeting as unself-conscious as a wave. That lugubrious mailman did not invite so much as a nod of recognition. Yet who was that someone my mother had been waving to? Whose was the last face she'd seen, the face she'd singled out in the crowd, the face she'd found there and had closed her eyes upon at the moment of her death? With a shudder, I tried to imagine who it could have been, if not my grandmother, if not Dan. "I wear the chain I forged in life," Marley's ghost told Scrooge. With my attention fixed upon the audience, I had known where I was in the play by the clanking of Marley's chains. "Mankind was my business," Marley told Scrooge. "The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." With a shudder, I imagined that it had been my father in the bleachers. It had been my father she'd waved to the instant she was killed. With no idea how I might hope to recognize him, I began with the front row left center. I went through the audience, face by face. From my perspective, backstage, the faces in the audience were almost uniformly still, and the attention upon them was not directed toward me. The faces were, at least in part, strangers to me, and, especially in the back rows, smaller than the faces on baseball cards. It was a futile search, but it was then and there that I started to remember. From backstage, watching the Christmas Eve faces of my fellow townspeople, I could begin to populate those bleacher seats on that summer day. Row by row, I could remember a few of the baseball fans who had been there. Mrs. Kenmore, the butcher's wife, and their son Donnie, a rheumatic fever baby who was not allowed to play baseball. They attended every game. They were in attendance at a Christmas carol to watch Mr. Kenmore slaughter the part of the Ghost of Christmas Present, but I could see them in their short-sleeved summer garb with their identically sunburned noses. They always sat down low in the bleachers because Donnie was not agile and Mrs. Kenmore feared he would fall through the slats. And there was Mr. Early's daughter, Maureen, reputed to have wet her pants when Owen Meany tried out for the part of the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come. She was here tonight, and she had been present every night to watch her father's vain attempts to make Marley's ghost resemble King Lear. She simultaneously worshipped and despised her father, who was a terrible snob, and regaled Maureen with both undeserved praise and a staggering list of his expectations for her. At the very least, she would one day have her doctorate, and if she were to indulge her fantasy and become a movie star, she would make her reputation on the silver screen only after numerous triumphs in legitimate theater. Maureen Early was a dreamer who squirmed in her seat, whether she was watching her father overact or watching Owen Meany approach home plate. I remembered that she had been sitting in the top row, squirming beside Caroline O'Day, whose father ran the Chevy dealership. Caroline O'Day was one of those rare parochial school girls who managed to wear her St. Michael's uniform, her pleated flannel skirt and matching burgundy knee socks, as if she were a cocktail waitress in a lounge of questionable repute. With boys, Caroline O'Day was as aggressive as a Corvette, and Maureen Early enjoyed her company because Mr. Early thought the O'Days were vulgar. It had not set well with Mr. Early that Caroline's father, Larry O'Day, had secured the part of Bob Cratchit. But Mr. O'Day was younger and handsomer than Mr. Early, and Dan Needham knew that a Chevy salesman's daring do was far preferable to Mr. Early's attempting to turn Bob Cratchit into King Lear. How I remembered them on that summer day, Maureen Early and Caroline O'Day, how they had laughed and squirmed in their seats together when Owen Meany came to bat. What a power, I had discovered. I felt certain I could refill those bleacher seats. One day, I was sure, I could see everyone who'd been there. I could find that special someone my mother had waved to at the end. Mr. Arthur Dowling had been there. I could see him shade his eyes with one hand, his other hand shading his wife's eyes. He was that sort of servant to her. Arthur Dowling was watching A Christmas Carol because his wife, the most officious member of the town library board, was steering her humorless self through the chore of being the ghost of Christmas past. Amanda Dowling was a pioneer in challenging sexual stereotypes. She wore men's clothes. Fancy dress for her meant a coat and tie, and when she smoked, she blew smoke in men's faces, this being at the heart of her opinions regarding how men behave toward women. Both her husband and Amanda were in favor of creating mayhem with sexual stereotypes, or reversing sexual roles as arduously and as self-consciously as possible. Hence, he often wore an apron while shopping. Hence, her hair was shorter than his, except on her legs and in her armpits, where she grew it long. There were certain positive words in their vocabulary. European, among them. Women who didn't shave their armpits or their legs were more European than American women, to their undoubted advantage. They were childless. Dan Needham suggested that their sexual roles might be so reversed as to make childbearing difficult. And their attendance at Little League games was marked by a constant disapproval of the sport. That little girls were not allowed to play in the Little League was an example of sexual stereotyping that exercised the Dowlings' humorlessness and fury. Should they have a daughter, they warned, she would play in the Little League. They were a couple with a theme. Sadly, it was their only theme, and a small theme, and they overplayed it. But a young couple with such a burning mission was quite interesting to the generally slow, accepting types who were more typical in Gravesend. Mr. Chickering, our fat coach and manager, lived in dread of the day the Dowlings might produce a daughter. Mr. Chickering was of the old school. He believed that only boys should play baseball and that girls should watch them play, or else play softball. Like many small-town world changers, the Dowlings were independently wealthy. He, in fact, did nothing, except he was a ceaseless interior decorator of his own well-appointed house and a manicure artist when the subject was his lawn. In his early 30s, Arthur Dowling had developed the habit of puttering to a level of frenzy quite beyond the capacities of the retired, who are conventionally supposed to be the putterers. Amanda Dowling didn't work either, but she was tireless in her pursuit of the board member life. She was a trustee of everything, and the town library was not the only board she served. It was simply the board she was most often associated with, because it was a board she served with special vengeance. Among the methods she preferred for changing the world, banning books was high on her list. Sexual stereotypes did not fall, she liked to say, from the clear blue sky. Books were the major influences upon children, and books that had boys being boys and girls being girls were among the worst offenders. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, for example. They were an education and condescension to women. All by themselves, they created sexual stereotypes. Wuthering Heights, for example. How that book taught a woman to submit to a man made Amanda Dowling see red, as she would say. As for the Dowlings' participation in the Gravesend Players, they took turns. Their campaign was relentless, but minor. She tried out for parts conventionally bestowed upon men. He went after the lesser women's roles, preferably non-speaking. She was more ambitious than he was, befitting a woman, determined to reverse sexual stereotypes. She thought that speaking parts for males were perfect for her. Dan Needham gave them what he could. To deny them outright would risk the charge they relished to make, and made often, that so-and-so was discriminatory. A patterned absurdity marked each Dowling's role on stage. Amanda was terrible as a man, but she would have been just as terrible as a woman, Dan was quick to point out, and Arthur was simply terrible. The townspeople enjoyed them in the manner that only people from small towns, who know how everyone's apron is tied and by whom, can enjoy tedious eccentrics. The Dowlings were tedious. Their eccentricity was flawed and made small by the utter predictability of their highly selective passions. Yet they were a fixture of the Gravesend Players that provided constant, if familiar, entertainment. Dan Needham knew better than to tamper with them. How I astonished myself that Christmas Eve. With diligence, with months, even years, backstage in the Gravesend Town Hall, I knew I could find the face my mother had waved to in the stands. Why not at the baseball games themselves, you might wonder? Why not observe the actual fans in the actual bleachers? People tend to take the same seats. But at Dan's Theater, I had an advantage. I could watch the audience unseen, and I would not be drawing attention to myself by putting myself between the field of play and them. Backstage, and all that this implies, is invisible. You can see more in faces that can't see you. If I was looking for my father, shouldn't I look for him unobserved? "Spirit," said Scrooge to the ghost of Christmas past, "remove me from this place." And I watched Mr. Arthur Dowling watching his wife, who said, "I told you these were shadows of the things that had been, that they are what they are," Amanda Dowling said. "Do not blame me." I watched my fellow townspeople snicker, all but Mr. Arthur Dowling, who remained seriously impressed by the reversed sexual role he saw before him. That the Dowlings took turns at the Gravesend Players, that they never took roles in the same play, was a great source of mirth to Dan, who enjoyed joking with Mr. Fish. "I wonder if the Dowlings take turns sexually," Dan would say. "It's most unpleasant to imagine," Mr. Fish would say. What daydreams I accomplished backstage on Christmas Eve. How I fed myself memories from the faces of my fellow townspeople. When Mr. Fish asked the ghost of Christmas present if the poor, wretched children were his, the spirit told him, "They are man's." How proud Mrs. Kenmore was of Mr. Kenmore the butcher. How the rheumatic heart of their son Donnie jumped for joy to see his father with words instead of meat at his fingertips. "This boy is ignorance," the butcher said. "This girl is want. Beware of them both, and all of their degree, but most of all beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be encased." He meant erased, but Mr. Kenmore was probably thinking of sausages. On the trusting faces of my fellow townspeople, there was no more awareness of Mr. Kenmore's error than Mr. Kenmore himself possessed. Of the faces I surveyed, only Harriet Wheelwright, who had seen almost as many versions of A Christmas Carol as Dan Needham had directed, winced to hear the butcher his line. My grandmother, a born critic, briefly closed her eyes and sighed. Such was my interest in the audience. I did not turn to face the stage until Owen Meany made his appearance. I did not need to see him to know he was there. A hush fell over the audience. The faces of my fellow townspeople, so amused, so curious, so various, were rendered shockingly similar. Each face became the model of each other's fear. Even my grandmother, so detached, so superior, drew her fur closer around her shoulders and shivered. An apparent draft had touched the necks of my fellow townspeople. The shiver that passed through my grandmother appeared to pass through them all. Donnie Kenmore clutched his rheumatic heart. Maureen Early, determined not to pee in her pants again, shut her eyes. The look of dread upon the face of Mr. Arthur Dowling surpassed even his interest in sexual role reversal, for neither the sex nor the identity of Owen Meany was clear. What was clear was that he was a ghost. ghost of the future," Mr. Fish exclaimed. "I fear you more than any specter I have seen." To observe the terror upon my fellow townspeople's faces was entirely convincing. It was obvious that they agreed with Mr. Fish's assessment of this ghost's fearful qualities. "Will you not speak to me?" Scrooge pleaded. Owen coughed. It was not, as Dan had hoped, a humanizing sound. It was a rattle so deep and so deeply associated with death that the audience was startled. People twitched in their seats. Maureen Early, abandoning all hope of containing her urine, opened her eyes wide and stared at the source of such an unearthly bark. That was when I turned to look at him, too. At the instant, his baby-powdered hand shot out of the black folds of his cowl, and he pointed. A fever chill sent a spasm down his trembling arm, and his hand responded to the jolt as to electricity. Mr. Fish flinched.
"Lead on!" cried Scrooge. "Lead on!"
Gliding across the stage, Owen Meany led him. But the future was never quite clear enough for Scrooge to see it, until at last they came to the churchyard. "A worthy place," Dickens called it. "Overrun by grass and weeds, the growth of vegetation's death, not life. Choked up with too much burying, fat with repleted appetite." "Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point," Scrooge began to say. Among the papier-mâché gravestones where Mr. Fish was standing, one stone loomed larger than the others. It was this stone that Owen pointed to, again and again. He pointed and pointed, so that Mr. Fish would stop stalling and get to the part where he reads his own name on that grave. Owen stepped closer to the gravestone himself. Scrooge began to babble. "Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead, but," Mr. Fish said to Owen, "if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me." Owen Meany, not moved to speak, bent over the gravestone, appearing to read the name he saw there to himself. He directly fainted. "Owen," Mr. Fish said crossly. But Owen was as committed to not answering as the ghost of the future. "Owen?" Mr. Fish asked, more sympathetically. The audience appeared to sympathize with Mr. Fish's reluctance to touch the slumped, hooded figure. It would be just like Owen, I thought, to regain consciousness by jumping to his feet and screaming. This was exactly what Owen did, before Dan Needham could call for the curtain. Mr. Fish fell over what was meant to be his grave, and the sheer terror in Owen's cry was matched by a corresponding terror in the audience. There were screams, there were gasps. I knew that Maureen Early's pants were wet again. Just what had the ghost of the future actually seen? Mr. Fish, a veteran at making the best of a mess, found himself sprawled on the stage in a perfect position to read his own name on the papier-mâché gravestone, which he had half-crushed in falling over it. "Ebenezer Scrooge, am I that man?" he asked Owen. But something was wrong with Owen, who appeared to be more frightened of the papier-mâché gravestone than Scrooge was afraid of it. Owen kept backing away. He retreated across the stage with Mr. Fish imploring him for an answer. Without a word, without so much as pointing again at the gravestone that had the power to frighten even the ghost of Christmas yet to come, Owen Meany retreated off stage. In the dressing room, he sobbed upon the makeup table, coating his hair with baby powder, the black eyeliner streaking his face. Dan Needham felt his forehead. "You're burning up, Owen," Dan said. "I'm getting you straight home and straight to bed." "What is it? What happened?" I asked Owen. But he shook his head and cried harder. "He fainted, that's what happened," Dan said. Owen shook his head. "Is he all right?" Mr. Fish asked from the door. Dan had called for a curtain before Mr. Fish's last scene. "Are you all right, Owen?" Mr. Fish asked. "My God, you looked as if you'd seen a ghost."
"I've seen everything now," Dan said. "I've seen Scrooge upstaged. I've seen the ghost of the future scare himself."
The Reverend Lewis Merrill came to the crowded dressing room to offer his assistance, although Owen appeared more in need of a doctor than a minister.
"Owen?" Pastor Merrill asked. "Are you all right?"
Owen shook his head.
"What did you see?"
Owen stopped crying and looked up at him. That Pastor Merrill seemed so sure that Owen had seen something surprised me. Being a minister, being a man of faith, perhaps he was more familiar with visions than the rest of us. Possibly he had the ability to recognize those moments when visions appear to others.
"What do you mean?"
Owen asked Mr. Merrill.
"You saw something, didn't you?"
Pastor Merrill asked Owen. Owen stared at him.
"Didn't you?" Mr. Merrill repeated.
"I saw my name on the grave," said Owen Meany.
Dan put his arms around Owen and hugged him.
"Owen, Owen, it's part of the story. You're sick, you have a fever. You're too excited. Seeing a name on that grave is just like the story. It's make-believe, Owen," Dan said.
"It was my name," Owen said. "Not Scrooge's."
The Reverend Mr. Merrill knelt beside him.
"It's a natural thing to see that, Owen," Mr. Merrill told him. "Your own name on your own grave. It's a vision we all have. It's just a bad dream, Owen."
But Dan Needham regarded Mr. Merrill strangely, as if such a vision were quite foreign to Dan's experience. He was not at all sure that seeing one's own name on one's own grave was exactly natural. Mr. Fish stared at the Reverend Lewis Merrill as if he expected more miracles on the order of the nativity he had only recently and for the first time experienced. In the baby powder on the makeup table, the name Owen Meany, as he himself had written it, was still visible. I pointed to it.
"Owen," I said, "look what you wrote yourself, just tonight. You see, you were already thinking about it. Your name, I mean."
But Owen Meany only stared at me. He stared me down. Then he stared at Dan until Dan said to Mr. Fish, "Let's get that curtain up. Let's get this over with." Then Owen stared at the Reverend Mr. Merrill until Mr. Merrill said, "I'll take you home right now, Owen. You shouldn't be waiting around for your curtain call with the temperature of the good Lord knows what." I rode with them. The last scene of A Christmas Carol was boring to me. After the departure of the ghost of Christmas yet to come, the story turns to syrup. Owen preferred staring at the darkness out the passenger side window to the lit road ahead.
"You had a vision, Owen," Pastor Merrill repeated.
I thought it was nice of him to be so concerned and to drive Owen home, considering that Owen had never been a Congregationalist. I noticed that Mr. Merrill's stutter abandoned him when he was being directly helpful to someone, although Owen responded ungenerously to the pastor's help. He appeared to be sullenly embracing his vision, like the typically doubtless prophet he so often seemed to be to me. He had seen his own name on his own grave. The world, not to mention Pastor Merrill, would have a hard time convincing him otherwise. Mr. Merrill and I sat in the car and watched him hobble over the snow-covered ruts in the driveway. There was an outside light left on for him, and another light was on in what I knew was Owen's room. But I was shocked to see that on Christmas Eve, his mother and father had not waited up for him.
"An unusual boy," said the pastor neutrally, as he drove me home.
Without thinking to ask me which of my two homes he should take me to, Mr. Merrill drove me to 80 Front Street. I wanted to attend the cast party Dan was throwing in Waterhouse Hall, but Mr. Merrill had driven off before I remembered where I wanted to be. Then I thought I might as well go inside and see if my grandmother had come home, or if Dan had persuaded her to kick up her heels, such as she was willing, at the cast party. I knew the instant I opened the door that Grandmother wasn't home. Perhaps they were still having curtain calls at the town hall. Maybe Mr. Merrill had been a faster driver than he appeared to be. I breathed in the still air of the old house. Lydia and Germaine must have been fast asleep, for even someone reading in bed makes a little noise, and 80 Front Street was as quiet as a grave. That was when I had the impression that it was a grave. The house itself frightened me. I knew I was probably jumpy after Owen's alarming vision, or whatever it was, and I was on the verge of leaving and of running down Front Street to the Gravesend Academy campus to Dan's dormitory when I heard Germaine. She was difficult to hear because she had hidden herself in the secret passageway, and she was speaking barely above a whisper, but the rest of the house was so very quiet I could hear her.
"Oh, Jesus, help me," she was saying. "Oh, God, oh, dear Christ, oh, good Lord, help me."
So there were thieves in Gravesend, I thought. The vestry members had been wise to lock the parish house. Christmas Eve bandits had pillaged 80 Front Street. Germaine had escaped to the secret passageway. But what had the robbers done to Lydia? Perhaps they had kidnapped her, or stolen her wheelchair and left her helpless. The books on the bookshelf door to the secret passageway were tumbled all about. Half of them were on the floor, as if Germaine in her panic had forgotten the location of the concealed lock and key, upon which shelf, behind which books. She'd made such a mess that the lock and key were now plainly visible to anyone entering the living room, especially since the books strewn upon the floor drew your attention to the bookshelf door.
"Germaine," I whispered. "Have they gone?"
"Have who gone?"
Germaine whispered back.
"The robbers,"
I whispered.
"What robbers?"
she asked me. I opened the door to the secret passageway. She was cringing behind the door, near the jams and jellies, as many cobwebs in her hair as adorned the relishes and chutneys in the cans of overused, spongy tennis balls that dated back to the days when my mother saved old tennis balls for Sagamore. Germaine was wearing her ankle-length flannel dressing gown, but she was barefoot, suggesting that the manner of her hiding herself in the secret passageway had not been unlike the way she cleared the table.
"Lydia is dead,"
Germaine said. She would not emerge from the cobwebs and shadows, although I held the heavy bookshelf door wide open for her.
"They killed her?"
I said in alarm.
"No one killed her,"
Germaine said. A certain mystical detachment flooded her eyes and caused her to slightly revise her statement.
"Death just came for her,"
Germaine said, shivering dramatically. She was the sort of girl who personified death. After all, she thought that Owen Meany's voice was simply the speaking vehicle for the devil.
"How did she die?"
I asked.
"In her bed, when I was reading to her," Germaine said. "She'd just corrected me,"
Germaine said. Lydia was always correcting Germaine, naturally. Germaine's pronunciation was especially offensive to Lydia, who modeled her own pronunciation exactly upon my grandmother's speech, and held Germaine accountable for any failures in imitating my grandmother's reading voice as well. Grandmother and Lydia often took turns reading to each other, because their eyes, they said, needed rest. So Lydia had died while resting her eyes, informing Germaine of her mispronunciation of this or that. Occasionally, Lydia would interrupt Germaine's reading and ask her to repeat a certain word. Whether correctly or incorrectly pronounced, Lydia would then say, "I'll bet you don't know what the word means, do you?" So Lydia had died in the act of educating Germaine, a task, in my grandmother's opinion, that had no end. Germaine had sat with the body as long as she could stand it.
"Things happen to the body,"
Germaine explained, venturing cautiously into the living room. She viewed the spilled books with surprise,
as if death had come for them, too. Or perhaps death had been looking for her and had flung the books about in the process.
"What things?" I asked.
"Not nice things," Germaine said, shaking her head. I could imagine the old house settling and creaking, groaning against the winter wind. Poor Germaine had probably concluded that death was still around. Possibly death had expected that coming for Lydia would have been more of a struggle. Having found her and taken her so easily, probably death felt inclined to stay and take a second soul. Why not make a night of it? We held hands, as if we were siblings taking a great risk together, and went to view Lydia. I was quite shocked to see her, because Germaine had not told me of the efforts she had made to shut Lydia's mouth. Germaine had bound Lydia's jaws together with one of her pink leg warmers, which she had knotted at the top of Lydia's head. Upon closer inspection, I saw that Germaine had also exercised considerable creativity in her efforts to permanently close Lydia's eyes. Upon closing them, she had fastened two unmatched coins, a nickel and a quarter, to Lydia's eyelids, with scotch tape. She told me that the only matching coin she could find had been dimes, which were too small, and that one eyelid fluttered, or it appeared to flutter, knocking the nickel off, hence the tape. She used the tape on both eyelids, she explained, even though the quarter had stayed in place by itself, because to tape one coin and not the other had not appealed to her sense of symmetry. Years later, I would remember her use of that word and conclude that Lydia and my grandmother had managed to educate Germaine a little. Symmetry, I was sure, was not a word in Germaine's vocabulary before she came to live at 80 Front Street. I would remember, too, that although I was only 11, such words were in my vocabulary, largely through Lydia's and my grandmother's efforts to educate me. My mother had never paid very particular attention to words, and Dan Needham let boys be boys. When Dan returned to 80 Front Street with my grandmother, Germaine and I were much relieved. We'd been sitting with Lydia's body, reassuring ourselves that death had come and got what it came for and gone, that death had left 80 Front Street in peace, at least for the rest of Christmas Eve. But we could not have gone on sitting with Lydia for very long. As usual, Dan Needham took charge. He'd brought my grandmother home from her brief appearance at the cast party, and he allowed the cast party to go on without him. He put grandmother to bed with a rum toddy. Naturally, Owen's outburst in A Christmas Carol had upset her, and now she expressed her conviction that Owen had somehow foreseen Lydia's death and had confused it with his own. This point of view was immediately convincing to Germaine, who remarked that while she was reading to Lydia, only shortly before Lydia died, both of them had thought they'd heard a scream. Grandmother was insulted that Germaine should actually agree with her about anything and wanted to disassociate herself from Germaine's hocus-pocus. It was nonsense that Lydia and Germaine could have heard Owen screaming all the way from the Gravesend Town Hall on a windy winter night with everyone's doors and windows shut. Germaine was superstitious and probably heard screaming of one kind or another every night. And Lydia, it was now clearly proven, was suffering from a senility much in advance of my grandmother's. Nonetheless, in grandmother's view, Owen Meany had certain unlikable powers. That he had foreseen Lydia's death was not superstitious nonsense, at least not on the level that Germaine was superstitious. "Owen foresaw absolutely nothing," Dan Needham told the agitated women. "He must have had a fever of 104. The only power he has is the power of his imagination." But against this reasoning, my grandmother and Germaine saw themselves as allies. There was, at the very least, some ominous connection between Lydia's death and what Owen saw. The powers of that boy went far beyond the powers of the imagination. "Have another rum toddy, Harriet," Dan Needham told my grandmother.
"Don't you patronize me, Dan," my grandmother said. "And shame on you,
she added, "for letting a stupid butcher get his bloody hands on such a wonderful part. Dismal casting," she told him.
I agree," Dan said.
It was also agreed that Lydia be allowed to lie in her own room with the door firmly shut. Germaine would sleep in the other twin bed in my room. Although I much preferred the idea of returning to Waterhouse Hall with Dan, it was pointed out to me that the cast party might rage on into the small hours, a likelihood that I had been looking forward to, and that Germaine, who was in a state, should not be left in a room alone. It would be quite improper for her to share a room with Dan, and unthinkable that my grandmother would sleep in the same room with a maid. After all, I was only 11. I had shared that room so many times with Owen. How I wanted to talk to him now. What would he think of my grandmother's suggestion that he had foreseen Lydia's death? And would he be relieved to learn that death didn't have a plan to come for him? Would he believe it? I knew he would be deeply disappointed if he missed seeing Lydia, and I wanted to tell him about my discovery, while watching the theater audience, that I believed I could, by this means, actually remember the faces in the audience at what Owen called that
faded
baseball game. What would Owen Meany say about my sudden inspiration? That it had been my actual father whom my mother was waving to the split second before the ball hit her. In the world of what the Reverend Lewis Merrill called visions, what would Owen make of that one? But Germaine distracted me. She wanted the nightlight left on. She tossed and turned. She lay staring at the ceiling. When I got up to go to the bathroom, she asked me not to be gone long. She didn't want to be left alone, not for a minute. If she would only fall asleep, I thought, I could telephone Owen. There was only one phone in the Meany house. It was in the kitchen, right outside Owen's bedroom. I could call him at any hour of the night because he woke up in an instant, and his parents slept through the night like boulders, like immovable slabs of granite. Then I remembered it was Christmas Eve. My mother had once said it was just as well that we went to Sawyer Depot for Christmas, because it prevented Owen from comparing what he got for Christmas with what I got. I got a half dozen presents from each relative or loved one, from my grandmother, from my aunt and uncle, from my cousins, from Dan, and more than a half dozen from my mother. I had looked under the Christmas tree this year in the living room of 80 Front Street, and was touched at Dan's and my grandmother's efforts to match the sheer number of presents, for me, that usually lay under the Eastman's tree in Sawyer Depot. I had already counted them. I had over 40 wrapped presents, and God knows there was usually something hidden in the basement or in the garage that was too big to wrap. I never knew what Owen got for Christmas, but it occurred to me that if his parents hadn't even waited up for him on Christmas Eve, that Christmas was not especially emphasized in the Meany household. In the past, by the time I came back from Sawyer Depot, half of my lesser toys were broken or lost, and the new things that were truly worth keeping were discovered by Owen gradually over a period of days or weeks.
"Where'd you get that?"
"For Christmas."
"Oh, yes, I see."
Now that I thought of it, I could not remember him ever showing me a single thing he got for Christmas. I wanted to call him, but Germaine kept me in my bed. The more I stayed in my bed, and the more I was aware of her, still awake, the stranger I began to feel. I began to think about Germaine the way I often thought about Hester. And how old would Germaine have been in 53? In her 20s, I suppose. I actually began to wish that she would climb into my bed, and I began to imagine climbing into hers. I don't think she would have prevented me. I think she would have favored an innocent hug and even a not-so-innocent boy in her arms, if only to keep death away. I began to scheme. Not at all in the manner of an 11-year-old, but in the manner of an older, horny boy. I began to imagine how much advantage I might take of Germaine, given that she was distraught. I actually said, I believe you about hearing him scream.
I lied. I didn't believe her at all.
It was his voice, she said instantly. Now that I remember it, I know it was.
I reached out my hand into the aisle between the twin beds. Her hand was there to take mine. I thought about the way Barb Wiggin had kissed Owen. I was rewarded with an erection powerful enough to slightly raise my bed covers. But when I squeezed Germaine's hand especially hard, she made no response. She just held on.
Go to sleep, she said.
When her hand slipped out of mine, I realized that she had fallen asleep. I stared at her for a long time, but I didn't dare approach her. I was ashamed of how I felt. In the considerably grown-up vocabulary that I had been exposed to through my grandmother and Lydia, I had not been exposed to lust. That was not a word I could have learned from them. That was not a feeling I could label. What I was experiencing simply felt wrong. It made me feel guilty that a part of myself was an enemy to the rest of myself, and that was when I thought I understood where the feeling came from. It had to come from my father. It was the part of him that stirred inside me. And for the first time, I began to consider that my father might be evil, or that what of himself he had given to me was what was evil in me. Henceforward, whenever I was troubled by a way I felt, and especially when I felt this way, when I lusted, I thought that my father was asserting himself within me. My desire to know who he was took on a new urgency. I did not want to know who he was because I missed him or because I was looking for someone to love. I had Dan and his love. I had my grandmother. And everything I remembered, and I'm sure exaggerated, about my mother. It was not out of love that I wanted to meet my father, but out of the darkest curiosity, to be able to recognize in myself what evil I might be capable of. How I wanted to talk to Owen about this. When Germaine started to snore, I got out of bed and crept downstairs to the kitchen phone to call him. The sudden light in the kitchen sent a resident mouse into rapid abandonment of its investigations of the bread box. The light also surprised me, because it turned the myriad colonial-style window panes into fragmented mirror images of myself. There instantly appeared to be many of me, standing outside the house looking in at me. In one image of my shocked face, I thought I recognized the fear and uneasiness peculiar to Mr. Morrison. According to Dan, Mr. Morrison's response to Owen's fainting spell and fit had been one of shock. The cowardly mailman had fainted. Chief Pike had carried the fallen postal thespian into the bracing night air, where Mr. Morrison had revived with a vengeance, wrestling in the snow with Gravesend's determined chief of police, until Mr. Morrison yielded to the strong arm of the law. But I was alone in the kitchen. The small, square, mirror-black panes reflected many versions of my face, but no other face looked in upon me as I dialed the meanie's number. It rang longer than I expected, and I almost hung up. Remembering Owen's fever, I was afraid he might be more soundly asleep than usual, and that Mr. and Mrs. Meany would be awakened by my call.
"Merry Christmas,"
he said, when he finally answered the phone. I told him everything. He was most sympathetic to the notion that I could remember the audience at the baseball game by observing the audience at Dan's play. He recommended that he watch with me, two pairs of eyes being better than one. As for my imagining that my mother had been waving to my actual father in the last second she was alive, Owen Meany believed in trusting such instincts. He said that I must be
on the right track,
because the idea gave him
the shivers,
a sure sign. And as for my desire for Germaine giving me a hard-on, Owen couldn't have been more supportive. If Barb Wiggin
could provoke lust in him, there was no shame in Germaine provoking such dreadful feelings in me. Owen had prepared a small sermon on the subject of lust, a feeling he would later describe as
a truthful premonition that damnation is for real.
As for the unpleasant sensation originating with my father, as for these hated feelings in myself being a first sign of my father's contribution to me, Owen was in complete agreement. Lust, he would later say, was God's way of helping me identify who my father was. In lust had I been conceived, in lust would I discover my father. It is amazing to me now how such wild imaginings and philosophies, inspired by a night charged with frights and calamities, made such perfectly good sense to Owen Meany and me. But good friends are nothing to each other if they are not supportive. Of course he agreed with me. How stupid Germaine was to imagine she'd heard him screaming all the way from the Gravesend Town Hall.
I didn't scream that loudly,
he said indignantly. It was Grandmother's interpretation of what he had foreseen that provided the only difference of opinion between us. If he had to believe anything, why couldn't he believe Grandmother that it was Lydia's death that the gravestone foretold, that Owen had simply seen the wrong name?
No,
he said.
It was my name, not Scrooge's, and not Lydia's.
But that was just your mistake, I said. You were thinking of yourself. You'd even been writing your own name just moments before, and you had a very high fever. If that gravestone actually told you anything, it told you that someone was going to die. That someone was Lydia. She's dead, isn't she? And you're not dead, are you?
It was my name,
he repeated stubbornly. Look at it this way. You got it half right, I told him. I was trying to sound as if I were an old hand at visions and at interpreting them. I tried to sound as if I knew more about the matter than Pastor Merrill.
It wasn't just my name, Owen said. I mean, not the way I ever write it, not the way I wrote it in the baby powder. It was my real name. It said the whole thing, he said.
That made me pause. He sounded so unbudging. His real name was Paul. His father's name. His real name was Paul O. Meany, Jr. He'd been baptized a Catholic. Of course, he needed a saint's name, like St. Paul. If there is a St. Owen, I've never heard of him. And because there was already a Paul in the family, I suppose that's why they called him Owen. Where that middle name came from, he never said. I never knew.
The gravestone said Paul O. Meany, Jr.? Is that right?
I asked him.
It said the whole thing,
Owen repeated. He hung up. He was so crazy, he drove me crazy. I stayed up drinking orange juice and eating cookies. I put some fresh bacon in the mousetrap and turned out the light. Like my mother, I hated darkness. In the dark, it came to me what he meant by
the whole thing.
I turned on the light. I called him back.
Merry Christmas,
he said.
Was there a date on the gravestone?
I asked him. He gave himself away by hesitating.
No,
he said.
What was the date, Owen?
I asked him. He hesitated again.
There was no date,
Owen said. I wanted to cry, not because I believed a single thing about his stupid vision, but because it was the first time he had lied to me.
Merry Christmas, I said.
I hung up. When I turned the light out a second time, there was more darkness in the darkness. What was the date? How much time had he given himself? The only question that I wanted to ask the darkness was the one question Scrooge had also wanted an answer to. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they shadows of the things that may be only? But the ghost of the future was not answering. Chapter 6. the voice. Above all things that she despised, what my grandmother loathed most was lack of effort. This struck Dan Needham as a peculiar hatred, because Harriet Wheelwright had never worked a day in her life, nor had she ever expected my mother to work, and she never once assigned me a single chore. Nevertheless, in my grandmother's view, it required nearly constant effort to keep track of the world, both our own world and the world outside the sphere of Gravesend. And it required effort and intelligence to make nearly constant comment on one's observations. In these efforts, grandmother was rigorous and unswerving. It was her belief in the value of effort itself that prevented her from buying a television set. She was a passionate reader, and she thought that reading was one of the noblest efforts of all. In contrast, she found writing to be a great waste of time, a childish self-indulgence, even messier than finger painting. But she admired reading, which she believed was an unselfish activity that provided information and inspiration. She must have thought it a pity that some poor fools had to waste their lives writing in order for us to have sufficient reading material. Reading also gave one confidence in and familiarity with language, which was a necessary tool for forming those nearly constant comments on what one had observed. Grandmother had her doubts about the radio, although she conceded that the modern world moved at such a pace that keeping up with it defied the written word. Listening, after all, required some effort, and the language one heard on the radio was not much worse than the language one increasingly stumbled over in newspapers and magazines. But she drew the line at television. It took no effort to watch. It was infinitely more beneficial to the soul and to the intelligence to read or to listen. And what she imagined there was to watch on TV appalled her. She had, of course, only read about it. She had protested to the Soldiers' Home and to the Gravesend Retreat for the Elderly, both of which she served as a trustee, that making television sets available to old people would surely hasten their deaths. She was unmoved by the claim made by both these homes for the aged, that the inmates were often too feeble or inattentive to read, and that the radio put them to sleep. My grandmother visited both homes, and what she observed only confirmed her opinions. What Harriet Wheelwright always observed always confirmed her opinions. She saw the process of death hastened. She saw very old, infirm people with their mouths agape. Although they were, at best, only partially alert, they gave their stuporous attention to images that my grandmother described as too surpassing in banality to recall. It was the first time she had actually seen television sets that were turned on, and she was hooked. My grandmother observed that television was draining what scant life remained in the old people clean out of them, yet she instantly craved a TV of her own. My mother's death, which was followed in less than a year by Lydia's death, had much to do with grandmother's decision to have a television installed at 80 Front Street. My mother had been a big fan of the old Victrola. In the evenings, we'd listen to Sinatra singing with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. My mother liked to sing along with Sinatra. "That Frank," she used to say, "he's got a voice that's meant for a woman, but no woman was ever that lucky." I remember a few of her favorites. When I hear them, I'm still tempted to sing along, although I don't have my mother's voice. I don't have Sinatra's voice either, nor his bullying patriotism. I don't think my mother would have been fond of Sinatra's politics, but she liked what she called his early voice, in particular those songs from Sinatra's first sessions with Tommy Dorsey. Because she liked to sing along with Sinatra, she preferred his voice before the war, when he was more subdued and less of a star, when Tommy Dorsey kept him in balance with the band. Her favorite recordings were from 1940. "I'll Be Seeing You," "Fools Rush In," "I Haven't Time to Be a Millionaire," "It's a Lovely Day Tomorrow," "All This in Heaven Too," "Where Do You Keep Your Heart?" trade winds, the call of the canyon, and most of all, too romantic. I had my own radio, and after Mother died, I listened to it more and more. I thought it would upset my grandmother to play, on the Victrola, those old Sinatra songs. When Lydia was alive, my grandmother seemed content with her reading. Either she and Lydia took turns reading to each other, or they forced Germaine to read aloud to them, while they rested their eyes and exercised their acute interest in educating Germaine. But after Lydia died, Germaine refused to read aloud to my grandmother. Germaine was convinced that her reading aloud to Lydia had either killed Lydia or had hastened her death, and Germaine was resolute in not wanting to murder grandmother in a similar fashion. For a while, my grandmother read aloud to Germaine, but this afforded no opportunity for grandmother to rest her eyes, and she would often interrupt her reading to make sure that Germaine was paying proper attention. Germaine could not possibly pay attention to the subject. She was so intent on keeping herself alive for the duration of the reading. You can see that this was a home already vulnerable to invasion by television. Ethel, for example, would never be the companion to my grandmother that Lydia had been. Lydia had been an alert and appreciative audience to my grandmother's nearly constant comments, but Ethel was entirely unresponsive, efficient but uninspired, dutiful but passive. Dan Needham sensed that it was Ethel's lack of spark that made my grandmother feel old. Yet whenever Dan suggested to grandmother that she might replace Ethel with someone livelier, my grandmother defended Ethel with bulldog loyalty. Wheelwrights were snobs, but they were fair-minded. Wheelwrights did not fire their servants because they were stodgy and dull. And so Ethel stayed, and my grandmother grew old and restless to be entertained. She was vulnerable to invasion by television, too. Germaine, who was terrified when my grandmother read to her, and too terrified to read aloud to grandmother at all, had too little to do. She resigned. Wheelwrights accept resignations graciously, although I was sorry to see Germaine go. The desire she had provoked in me, as distasteful as it was to me at the time, was a clue to my father. Moreover, the lustful fantasies that Germaine provided were, although evil, more entertaining to me than anything I could hear on my radio. With Lydia gone, and with me spending half my days and nights with Dan, grandmother didn't need two maids. There was no reason to replace Germaine. Ethel would suffice. And with Germaine gone, I was vulnerable to invasion by television, too.
"Your grandmother is getting a television?" said Owen Meany.
The Meanys did not have a television. Dan didn't have one either. He'd voted against Eisenhower in 1952, and he'd promised himself that he wouldn't buy a TV as long as Ike was president. Even the Eastmans didn't have a television. Uncle Alfred wanted one, and Noah and Simon and Hester begged to have one, but TV reception was still rather primitive in the North Country. Sawyer Depot received mostly snow, and Aunt Martha refused to build a tower for the necessary antenna. It would be too unsightly, she said, although Uncle Alfred wanted a television so badly that he claimed he would construct an antenna tower capable of interfering with low-flying planes if it could get him adequate reception.
"You're getting a television?" Hester said to me on the phone from Sawyer Depot. "You lucky little prick."
Her jealousy was thrilling to hear. Owen and I had no idea what would be on television. We were used to the Saturday matinees at the decrepit Gravesend movie house, inexplicably called the Idaho, after the faraway western state or the potato of that name we never knew. The Idaho was partial to Tarzan films, and increasingly to biblical epics. Owen and I hated the latter. In his view, they were
sacrilegious.
In my opinion, they were boring. Owen was also critical of Tarzan movies.
All that stupid swinging on vines, and the vines never break? And every time he goes swimming, they send in the alligators or the crocodiles. Actually, I think it's always the same alligator or crocodile. The poor creature is trained to wrestle with Tarzan. It probably loves Tarzan. And it's always the same old elephant stampeding, and the same lion, the same leopard, the same stupid warthog. And how can Jane stand him? He's so stupid. All these years he's been married to Jane and he still can't speak English. The stupid chimpanzee is smarter,
Owen said. But what really made him cross were the pygmies. They gave him
the shivers.
He wondered if the pygmies got jobs in other movies. He worried that their blowguns with their poison darts would soon be popular with
juvenile gangs.
Where? I asked. What juvenile gangs?
Maybe they're in Boston, he said.
We had no idea what to expect from Grandmother's television. There may have been pygmy movies on The Late Show in 1954, but Owen and I were not allowed to watch The Late Show for several years. My grandmother, for all her love of effort and regulation, imposed no other rules about television upon us. For all I know, there may not have been a late show as long ago as 1954. It doesn't matter. The point is, my grandmother was never a censor. She simply believed that Owen and I should go to bed at a decent hour. She watched television all day and every evening. At dinner, she would recount the day's inanities to me, or to Owen, or Dan, or even Ethel, and she would offer a hasty preview of the absurdities available for nighttime viewing. On the one hand, she became a slave to television. On the other hand, she expressed her contempt for nearly everything she saw, and the energy of her outrage may have added years to her life. She detested TV with such passion and wit that watching television and commenting on it, sometimes commenting directly to it, became her job. There was no manifestation of contemporary culture that did not indicate to my grandmother how steadfast was the nation's decline, how merciless our mental and moral deterioration, how swiftly all-embracing our final decadence. I never saw her read a book again. But she referred to books often, as if they were shrines and cathedrals of learning that television had plundered and then abandoned. There was much on television that Owen and I were unprepared for, but what we were most unprepared for was my grandmother's active participation in almost everything we saw. On those rare occasions when we watched television without my grandmother, we were disappointed. Without Grandmother's running, scathing commentary, there were few programs that could sustain our interest. When we watched TV alone, Owen would always say,
"I can just hear what your grandmother would make of this!"
Of course, there is no heart, however serious, that finds the death of culture entirely lacking in entertainment. Even my grandmother enjoyed one particular television show. To my surprise, Grandmother and Owen were devoted viewers of the same show. In my grandmother's case, it was the only show for which she felt uncritical love. In Owen's case, it was his favorite among the few shows he had first adored. The unlikely figure who captured the rarely uncritical hearts of my grandmother and Owen Meany was a shameless crowd-pleaser, a musical panderer, who chopped up Chopin and Mozart and Debussy into 2 and 3 minute exaggerated flourishes on a piano he played with diamond-studded hands. He at times played a see-through, glass-topped piano, and he was proud of mentioning the hundreds of thousands of dollars that his pianos cost. One of his diamond rings was piano-shaped, and he never played any piano that was not adorned with an ornate candelabrum. In the childhood of television, he was an idol, largely to women older than my grandmother and of less than half her education, yet my grandmother and Owen Meany loved him. He'd once appeared as a soloist for the Chicago Symphony when he was only 14, but now, in his wavy-haired 30s, he was a man who was more dedicated to the visual than to the acoustic.
He wore floor-length furs and sequined suits. He crammed $60,000 worth of chinchilla onto one coat. He had a jacket of 24-karat gold braid. He wore a tuxedo with diamond buttons that spelled out his name.
"Liberace!"
Owen cried every time he saw the man. His TV show appeared 10 times a week. He was a ridiculous peacock of a man, with a honey-coated feminine voice and dimples so deep that they might have been the handiwork of a ball-peen hammer.
"Why don't I slip out and get into something more spectacular?" he would coo.
Each time, my grandmother and Owen would roar with approval, and Liberace would return to his piano, having changed his sequins for feathers. Liberace was an androgynous pioneer, I suppose, preparing the society for freaks like Elton John and Boy George. But I could never understand why Owen and grandmother liked him. It certainly wasn't his music, for he edited Mozart in such a jaunty fashion that you thought he was playing Mack the Knife. Now and then he played Mack the Knife, too. "He loves his mother," my grandmother would say, in Liberace's defense. And in truth, it seemed to be true. Not only did he ooh and ah about his mother on TV, but it was reported that he actually lived with the old lady until she died, in 1980.
"He gave his brother a job," Owen pointed out, "and I don't think George is especially talented."
Indeed, George, the silent brother, played a straight man's violin until he left the act to become the curator of the Liberace Museum in Las Vegas, where he died in 1983. But where did Owen get the idea that Liberace was
especially talented?
To me, his principal gift was how unselfconsciously he amused himself. And he was capable of making fun of himself, too. But my grandmother and Owen Meany twittered over him as hysterically as the blue-haired ladies in Liberace's TV audience did, especially when the famous fool skipped into the audience to dance with them.
"He actually likes old people," my grandmother said in wonder.
"He would never hurt anyone,"
said Owen Meany admiringly. At the time, I thought he was a fruitcake. But a London columnist, who made a similar slur regarding Liberace's sexual preferences, lost a libel judgment to him. That was in 1959. On the witness stand, Liberace testified that he was opposed to homosexuality. I remember how Owen and my grandmother cheered. And so, in 1954, my excitement over the new television at 80 Front Street was tempered by the baffling love of my grandmother and Owen Meany for Liberace. I felt quite excluded from their mindless worship of such a kitschy phenomenon. My mother would never have sung along with Liberace. And I expressed my criticism, as always, to Dan. Dan Needham took a creative, often a positive, view of misfortune. Many faculty members in even the better secondary schools are failures in hiding, lazy men and women whose marginal authority can be exercised only over adolescents. But Dan was never one of these. Whether he hoped to retire at Gravesend Academy when he first fell in love and married my mother, I'll never know. But her loss and his reaction to that injustice caused him to devote himself to the development of the education of the whole boy in ways that surpassed even the loftily